Everybody, we are back at the TCP, and I am John Stamp. And to start tonight, quick announcement. I'm announcing my retirement, official retirement as a flag football coach, ages 5 to 7 year olds, Glynn County Recreation. I've decided it's time. Though I did come on as a late addition a week before kickoff, I knew it'd be a challenge, but I also, once again, could not deny that call to serve. My boys are strong. They're hard chargers. That is to say, once we learned which way the end zone was. And even though we got a late start getting organized, we had a powerful showing all season. The strategic partner Gamers had the only two passing touchdowns in the league all season. So we had the greatest air attack of any Georgia-based 5 to 7 year old flag football team in all of 2023. And when I make that claim, the stat I'm relying on is that we had the most passing attempts of any team all season. When I say that 2023 would be a season to remember, that's clearly an understatement. All that said, with all the success the Gamers saw in 2023, I still have to recognize that when it's your time, it's your time. There needs to be room for new talent to emerge and take on the leadership challenge that I know new coaches can shoulder. That's why, with a heavy heart, I'm hanging up my whistle. It was only one season, but it was one for the ages. I've already talked to the team. I waited for the final whistle last night after the last down was run, after the last high five was had, to tell them the hard truth that this is the way it was going to be. They responded like champions, and in one voice they stated like men, "Cool, Coach Stamp, are there snacks?" To that, I said, "Yes, you little grinders. There are snacks and juice boxes." So thank you, everyone, especially the team. Just had to take that moment to put the rumors to bed. I'm officially stepping away from the game, and I appreciate all your support throughout that long career I've had. So just had to get that off my chest. But for real, though, I did just get done coaching flag football for Red Five's six-year-old team. And I've coached soccer. I've coached T-ball. Football, though, is different, and it took me 9 games to figure out the difference, and that difference is stimulus. In soccer, and even in T-ball, there's always something going on. There's a ball to be chased or somebody coming up the bat. You don't realize it, but in football, there's a void of stimulus after every play. And with that said, do you have any idea how hard it is to wrangle 9 5- and 6-year-old boys after they've all scattered across the football field and get them back to the line and ready to play before the next snap? That shit was exhausting, bottom line. Fun, but exhausting. The question comes up, I don't know if I'll make first ballot for the Georgia Juvenile Flag Football Hall of Fame or not. That's not for me to decide, and I wouldn't want to influence those stakeholders, those decision makers in any way. Will I be surprised if I'm first ballot Hall of Fame? No, not a chance. But again, we're going to let history decide. That's not for me to say. And with that being said, seriously, that was fun, but enough football. We're going to get to it. On the me side, I don't have much to report. I can say that since Halloween, the second best holiday of the year is coming, I'm doing a giveaway. Shattered Circle, the first of the Jackson Cole novels, my horror police thriller, will be on Kindle for free October 26th to 28th. So make sure you mark that in your calendar. Ty Benhoff 2 is, like Superman had a bad shot and like sent it to the Phantom Zone. I have no idea. It's out there someplace. If it ever emerges from the Phantom Zone, I will definitely be the first one to let you guys know. Until then, tonight, let's get to it. I'm going to talk to a very special guest. Tonight, I'm talking to Brian Andrews of the Andrews and Wilson writing team. Brian Andrews is a U.S. Navy veteran, a Park Leadership Fellow, and a former submarine officer with a psychology degree from Vanderbilt and a master's in business from Cornell University, my neck of the woods. Brian's also principal contributor at Career Authors, a site dedicated to advancing the careers of aspiring writers and published writers. Tonight, we're going to talk about their upcoming book, Sons of Valor 3, War Machine. In War Machine, Chunk and Whitney, forced into a deadly match of wits with a terrorist mastermind and a terrifying weapon unlike anything they've ever encountered. After a shootout in Dubai left Hamza al-Saud dead and elevated brilliant aeronautical engineer Qasim Nadar to hero status in England, everybody assumes the terrorist threat from al-Qaeda has been eliminated. Everybody except JSOC counterterrorism analyst Whitney Watts. When she decides to help MI6 penetrate Nadar's network, Watts gets in a little too close to the truth and finds herself in a situation not even her teammates from Tier 1 can save her from. As Lieutenant Commander Keith Chunk Redman and the rest of Tier 1 fan out across London and search for Watts, Nadar appears to unleash his most dangerous weapon yet, an advanced drone with artificial intelligence and stealth technology, a very bad combination. To stop the horrifying attack on London, Chuck and his SEAL brethren must seek help from an unexpected ally and find a way to stop a war machine that was designed to be unstoppable. So, Brian, thank you so much for reaching out and joining me.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So looking at, you know, we always starting with the background. And growing up, I think Hunt for Red October was probably the second book I read growing up. And the whole time I'm like, man, that would be so cool. Like, you know, Alec Baldwin, awesome. Sean Connery, just the man. The whole time I'm like, yeah. And the dude that was on the radar, the radar man, who's like, you know, the dude with the ears, the whole time I'm like, yeah, that sounds like a really cool gig. Like, I would do that someday. That's probably eighth grade. And yeah, like, I think like on a field trip or something, junior year, we actually toured a sub and I was like, yeah, that is that dreams to bed. Like, I was like, I don't know. I've never thought it was claustrophobic. Like, I'm the guy who fall asleep in a MRI machine. But man, I stepped in that thing. I'm like, hold on, this goes hundreds of feet underwater and just hangs out. I'm like, nope.
Yeah. So, I love it. Nope. That's the reaction a lot of people have.
Yeah. So with the when I was doing research, my question is, you know, you got a psychology degree from Vanderbilt. Do they get far enough through that training program where that's not a question, or is there a time every new sub sailor has to close that hatch and you just don't know if they're going to handle it? Like, is that a thing? Like, is there some people that get underwater and it just gets in their head and they just kind of like, this is not for me, but they don't figure it out until they're 500 feet below the surface?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are some pretty big funny stories about that. In my entire time, there was only one dude who had that reaction. We submerged and he sort of freaked out and he ran towards the bridge lower trunk hatch. And he started to try to climb up the ladder to open it. You know, we had two hatches on the bridge, so it's double protection. So, I mean, the chances of him, you know, if the first hatch was leaking by or a valve had opened and the bridge trunk was actually full of water, that would have been a problem. But I mean, the chances are that he wouldn't have done anything at all. But the fact that he thought he had to get out and he could get out that way, you know, was a little funny and a little sad. You know, I don't think he really, maybe the recruiters didn't really explain what he was getting himself into. And, you know, he was sort of, he was not a happy camper, but he went on mission. Once you're down and once you go, you're gone, you know, you're at sea and we're not coming back unless somebody gets really hurt or there's some accident or something. So,
yeah. So it's basically like, I hear your concerns and I'm going to give you this straw so you can suck it up. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. I had some contact with that program. Mostly I was in Syracuse. So I had some work in Saratoga Springs over time. I had some work over in Charleston for a time. And the students in those programs just, you know, clearly, you know, cause you worked with them, but you know, you sit down with somebody and they're next level. Like, you just know that if they decide to start talking, you're not going to be able to take notes fast enough if they really get into it. That that was one of the few places or the few groups of people where I was like, this is across the board. Like, these people are, I don't know the recruiting process to hire the sub cadre, but man, that's just, I don't know what they do to get them, but man, they're just next level. And looking at their training, clearly they have to be. But what is it? How do they weed out? Like, these kids are young and they're just so intelligent. It was hard to fathom sometimes.
Yeah, there's definitely a vetting process, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, if you're on the officer track, they're going to look at your grades and your test scores and what preparatory classes that you've taken in your undergraduate degree. You know, 90% of the applicants are engineers. I was sort of an outlier as a psychology guy. But every applicant then has to go to Naval Reactors. All the officers do, at least, have to go to Naval Reactors. And you have to go through a couple of days of, you know, written and oral examination by the engineers who work at Naval Reactors, who are the actual people who did the calculations and designed the system. So, you know, when you're doing an interview with somebody on, you know, a fuel plate construction in the reactor core, the guy who's asking you the questions is the actual dude who did the calculations the poison loading and the fuel loading and the geometry and all that stuff. So you cannot BS these people. I mean, they are geniuses and they're the ones who did the work originally. There's a massive calling process at each step of the way. And then, you know, after you pass that exam, you have to go to Naval Nuclear Power School, which means you got to graduate through that course load. So there's calling there. And then you have to go to prototype, which is an operational command. It's a reactor. It's basically the back half of a submarine on land, so to speak, with the entire engine room and the reactor control room and, all the switch gear and control cabinets, everything. It's just like, imagine just cutting off a back of submarine and setting it on the land. And you have to operate and go through that training. So there's all these places where you can wash out. And then once you go to the fleet, you have to go through qualifications on your individual boat. And some people wash out there. So there's all these places that, you know, eliminate people who are either not motivated or just don't have the mental horsepower to, you know, execute in that position.
Yeah. And it's, it occurred to me in the opening pages of Sons of Valor 3, where you lay out what a submarine's capable of. You know, you lay out that, you know, when it's who is it? And his sister. The sister's an officer. And
Spence.
Spence, that's some great dialogue there. It's nothing better than having your buddy talk about how hot your sister is. But yeah, it's something I've noticed over the years. And I don't know if everyone appreciates it, but the level of maturity that we get in these young men and women who will sign up whatever service, will sign up at 17 on a delayed enlistment or get out of high school and just jump right in. The level of maturity that you see in them when they're in an expeditionary environment or when they're going about their operations is something that I know, and I've said it before, I know at my age, when I was in their comparative age at 18, 19 years old, I was a bubble-eating moron, right?
Yeah.
Seriously. As I was reading that, you know, it's sometimes hard to kind of render, but these are young people in charge of a massive weapon, right? The maturity level there is like, it's hard to fathom sometimes having an 18, 19 year old kid, maybe 20, 22, but they are in control of a country killing weapon, you know, so to speak. And, and it's just, I appreciate that out of people that can do that in that stressful environment, but it always gets to me just the level of maturity that I don't know if the greater society appreciates out of very young people that are in very responsible positions in that.
Yeah, I mean, there were many times when, you know, when I was engineering off the watch, I'd be the senior, you know, person in maneuvering, you know, and I'm 24 years old and I'm there operating a nuclear reactor. And I've got, like you said, a 19-year-old, a 20-year-old, and maybe a 21-year-old in front of me as the throttleman, reactor operator, and electrical operator. And, you know, so it's just four kids running this nuclear reactor, you know, in the middle of a submerged warship. And then, you know, the same thought would occur to me when I made officer deck and I'm standing watching now, you know, what a lot of people don't understand in the movies, they always put the captain's the one who's driving the submarine around. But for that's like 1% of the time, you know, in real life, the officer deck is acting in the captain's stead. The captain is serving as captain, but he's not up there giving orders to the helm. You know, he's not on the Periscope. You know, he'll be on the con when you go to Periscope depth. And if there's a tactical situation, then he will take the con. But for 99% of the time, it's the qualified officer corps who are qualified officer deck that are driving the submarine, you know, conducting those operations. And when I qualified officer deck and I pinned on my Dolphins and I started standing watch by myself, believe me, it was not lost to me that, you know, again, now I'm the ripe old age of 26, you know, and it's like, here I am, you know, in control of this $3 billion warship with missiles and a reactor and 100 souls on board. And they're all counting on me not to mess up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something I always appreciate about our service members that I always want to, you know, just take the chance to just give my take on just how impressive those people are at that generation. You know, it's something that's always stuck with me. As I was reading, Sons of Valor, the question, that I highlighted and starred, and I don't want to take away too much from exploring the book, but also it's a tough balance. You don't want to give anything away. But the question that I wrote down in the margins was, is it plot or chemistry that drives a great book? And I thought that'd be a great way to kind of kick us off.
Yeah, no, I love that question. So I think one of the things that as a co-author that Jeff and I decided very early on that appealed to us is even though we were going to be writing military thrillers, we really liked the idea of, you know, longitudinal storytelling where we have characters that you get to know and live with for a long time. So, you know, we are authors who write series. That's what we do. And so these relationships are sort of go hand in hand with the plot. I don't think we can write a book one without the other, right? So what we do is we try to craft a plot that puts our characters in situations that test those relationships, right? And strain them. They're stress tested with their loyalties and their morality in every single novel in different ways. And what's neat is, you know, as the series advances and you get more books under your belt with those characters, those relationships get stronger and deeper between those characters. They've, you know, had shared suffering. They've been through, you know, the suck and made it out. But then every time something new happens, right, sometimes there's emotional baggage and you come back to things that just like in real life, maybe it was a little more comfortable, a little easier not to talk about something and just, you know, maybe sweep something under the rug. And we do that on purpose because, like I said, in real life, people do that. And then it's very interesting in fiction to come back to those things later and when they rear their ugly head and suddenly now this, you know, trust is a question or, you know, how is the relationship going to be affected moving forward?
Yeah. And when that question came up for me was, it was really the way, Chunk and Saw when they break out into England. I'm not going to give any big stuff away, but, you know, you put those guys who have been together so long and worked so hard and been through the ups and the downs, and you give them time to get fidgety on a surveillance, yeah, you know, and start, yeah, getting on each other's nerves. And then, just the, you know, you say brotherhood, but it came down to my mind. It was the chemistry of those characters. You know, the plots are amazing. Between the monster you got hiding in the background with Valkyrie and just the, you know, Whitney's out on her thing going through the ringer. And when I read that part, you know, that just sitting there getting on each other's nerves because they're stuck in a car just waiting to go. They're just waiting for the green light. And you feel it. You get amped up and you get ramped. And then also, you know, like you said, Saw's got stuff going on. I think it was, yeah, Edwards. Yeah. Saw's got stuff going on. And, you know, most of the time in our line of work, we're just like, okay, we're going to have a great time. We're going to find a great bad guy. We're going to have some pretty kick-ass action scenes. And yeah, we go, you know, the shooters go get them. They have some close calls, but you know, you take the time out of that to be like, well, okay, here's this guy, well-trained professional and running 100% ahead. But back home, he's got, he's got decisions to make. It doesn't matter how great this job is or this adventure that you get to go on for a career. This is the point in that career where you have to make a decision on what's your priority. And I know that I ruined my wife's career 3 times moving her around. So I've, you know, not to the severity that these guys live by, but it's just when you're reading it, you're just like, man, that is one of those things we don't get to see in the fiction world is, here's this sniper who is just amazing at his job, loves his work, but mom has questions, right? And that can create career changes. And I love the humanity. I think that's where that question came from. I love the humanity that you guys built into those characters.
Yeah, thanks. And when we were thinking about that scene, we were thinking about Chung. And, you know, our first reaction was that, you know, he's going to be like, hey, you know, like, do whatever you need to do, brother. Like, I'll support you. That's sort of the fairy tale leadership response. And that's what's in Chunk's heart. But then what we realize is, you know, in real life, he has to look at it and say, you know what? You know, what's best for the team is really if Saw stays. And that's what's best for me too. So, you know, that is part of the burden of leadership is that, you know, you work for the United States Navy, you work for the Joint Special Operations Command. There are not just guys like Saw that grow on trees that you can just pick off and replace this guy. Even if you replace him with a capable sniper, there's going to be a learning curve. And while that new person is getting up to speed, you know, your unit is going to be below its capability when they had the old guy. So, you know, he has to wrestle with the fact, and we have this scene where he's talking with his CSO, where he's basically like, you know, I expect you to do what's right for the Navy. And that puts him in a difficult situation. And it'll be fun. You know, I'm not, like you said, I don't want to give any spoilers for how Chunk decides to resolve that, but he is caught between a rock and a hard place when Saw starts thinking about retirement.
Yeah, it goes against, there's the leaders eat last, servant leadership thing. Always, you know, happy people, happy unit. But yeah, the guy makes the point. I've spent $2 million training this dude. This is not an asset I can let go, you know?
Yeah.
I love that drama, that twist that, again, you know, reading sometimes in the fast paced world, taking those moments to be like, oh man, that just drives home such a humanity to these characters that's why I was, you know, is it the fast paces, car chases, shootouts, or is it that humanity in those little bits before those shootouts start that really drive the fan base and drive the books? And I didn't expect a clear answer for me at all. I just thought it was a great one to start with, you know.
It's a great question. I think, you know, for the sake of being honest, it's for us, it's both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got to find that balance. So when I was looking at your series, and there's, I mean, between the series, the you got Tier One, Sons of Valor, Shepherds, taking on Jack Ryan and writing for W.E.B. Griffin. It's, do you guys, there's that delicate balance between being artists and being businessmen. And I'm not sure if I could write a book with another person. I think it'd be cool, but as far as divvying that up, how did you guys divvy up work or agree on the parameters of the partnership when you got started? Is it business driven, art driven, or a good mix of both? Like, it's gotta be a good mix of both to put out a good product, but with your business background, I just wondered if you guys attack it as a business enterprise or what your paradigm is.
Yeah, I think we put the business first. And it's not necessarily incongruous to say that good business makes good art. And let me explain why. If you say your business is storytelling and we're in the business of delivering a product to our readers, who are our customers, that's the best military thriller possible. That means that what we want to do is not worry about the things like I wrote this sentence or Jeff wrote that one or pride of ownership over this idea or I thought of this plot point. It's not a competition between the two of us. And the art of the book is this is really been redefined in our model. And what I mean by that is we look at the finished product as the result of our combined effort. So as a parent, you can probably relate to this. Like if somebody asked you, you know, well, which kids are yours and which ones are your wives? You'd laugh. You'd be like, our kids are both of ours. Like we both contributed to parenting these children. And I cannot tell you on a given day, like what I said and what my wife said and what advice she gave on and what advice I gave them. And it's a team effort and it takes time. And so these books might sound a little corny, but they're like our kids, you know, like we both poured a lot of heart and soul and energy into them. And we really can't by the end of the day, always remember who did what, because we're talking on the phone 3 or 4 times a day, trying to figure out what to do with the plot. And so like today, for example, we're working on Tier 1, Book 8, and I'm going to be writing a chapter that's a hit on a mountain compound. And so I called Jeff Dozzle, let's talk about, you know, how this scene's going to unfold. And I honestly do not remember who came up with what idea during that conversation, but I have a bunch of notes and together we came up with like, well, here's what we want to accomplish in this scene. And that's going to go into the book. And then I'm going to write the rough draft and he's going to edit it. He's going to change some sentences. And then I'm going to do the same on his chapters. And then in DE, our editor is going to come in and he's going to suggest changes. And then I'm going to make some, and then he's going to just do a pass. And then our copy editor is going to come in and she's going to suggest changes. And so by the end of the day, like there have been 4 or 5 people whose, you know, hands have been on this book, tweaking the sentences and the plot and elements in the story. And so it truly is a team effort by the end. So it would be very arrogant and quite erroneous for me to say that it's my book. And so that's the coolest part about co-authoring with Jeff is that we set that goal very early. On the first act of Tier 1, our very first book we wrote together, we said we're going to take our ego. Well, at the time, we said we're going to try to take our ego out of the equation. And then, but we did. So, you know, by setting these ground rules, we really did take our ego out of the equation. And we celebrated the completion of the book with, you know, cracking open bottle of wine, toasting each other and being like, great job, brother. Like this book's freaking awesome. And that's how we've maintained. That's how we roll now.
Yeah. And did that come right out of the gate or did it, was there,
it honestly
warming up?
No, it came right out of the gate because Jeff was a little hesitant to start. He's like, I don't understand how co-authoring is going to work because I just write my own stuff and you write your own stuff and our styles are different and stuff. And I said, well, I don't know how it's going to work either. I think we just split up the chapters. And then he came back and he's like, I think we have to have this approach where it's like, you know, I can change anything you write. You can change anything I write. And it's just about the story. You know, it's about us writing the story together. And that was great that he came up with that approach and that we really leaned into that hard. So it's been from day one.
Yeah, that's amazing that you could just hit it and just run in the way you did. That's very cool. And it also probably goes back to this, you know, like you said, the all the sea trials and all the qualifications, the feedback in the professional environment is, you know, you screw something up, it's you screwed this up and you need to get better and you need to do it fast. Right. So,
yeah, we were already primed in conditions from our careers in the military. This was already our mindset. So it might not work with other people who are not coming from that sort of professional environment. You cannot run a submarine by yourself. You cannot take a terrorist compound by yourself. The SEALs do it as a team. The submarine crew is a team. And we are used to relying on each other and then handing off the watch to somebody else. Handing off the watch is what we do when we're co-authoring, you know, okay, I'm passing a baton to you to write this chapter and vice versa. So, you know, we were already programmed to do that.
Yep. And candy coated feedback does nothing but slow the whole process down. So it's when that way, if you can start with the honesty, it's, you know, you don't have to glaze anything. You just go, you know, like, I didn't like this. Oh, cool. What you got? Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Taking the ego out of it's very, very difficult for most people to do. And that kind of, another question I had was, so the five different series, I've tried to write two books at once before, and one of them, the story, I was trying to hand jam the story in, it wasn't working, and the characters, I don't know if this sounds nuts, but they were just kind of like trying to elbow each other out of the way when it came to writing time. Mm-hmm. Do you guys write singular focus on one, or are you able to stage it and write multiples at the same time?
We're always writing one rough draft, and then other books come and intrude for edits. So there's always one book in DE and one book in rough at the same time. Sometimes there's a book popping its head in there for copy edits too at the same time. It depends on the production schedules. But I'd say normally what we're at is a rough draft in DE on two different books at the same time. But because the DE comes right after the rough, your head's still in that space. It's distracting sometimes to have to, one of us always has to pull off the new project to go back and fix, you know, the previous project. But we tried writing two books in a series back to back. We wrote Dark Angel and Dark Rising in the Shepherd series back to back. And we thought, oh, this is going to be the best thing ever. Like, cause we've never done that before. And it's funny, like, we didn't like it. You know, we'd rather actually jump from series to series, because we do, like you're saying, the characters sort of elbowing each other. It's funny you say that, because it's like the characters want their airtime and they want their stories to continue. So it's like, you know, by having to write two back to back, the other characters are waiting and they're like annoyed. So it's like our brains, and maybe just our short attention spans, where maybe we're like children, but we'd like to jump to the next project as soon as we finish a book.
Yeah, and it's probably kind of akin to cleansing the palate a little bit. If you can finish up a Sons of Valor, go back to Shepherd, just empty out that guy, come back to Clancy or whatever, and be able to just, I found that when I skip from, because I start, my first one was like a horror police procedural, move straight over to crime thriller, follow that up with another fantasy, a whole different genre, cleanse it out, and then be ready to jump back in. And it, when I tried to do back-to-back crime thrillers, it was like, by the time I got done, I was like, I gotta do something else real quick. And
yeah. Yeah. So you get it.
That's, well, yeah, I don't have this, the 20, however many books you guys have, but for me, just figuring this out as I go is like, my next one, Ted Benhoff 3 mapped out, but as I'm looking at it, it's, I've got, you know, this little whisper in my head being like, you should do something completely different. And there's my next one's going to be a sci-fi book. I'm like, okay, I'll go knock out some sci-fi and come back to the crime side.
Yeah.
And as soon as I started writing, as soon as I got my outline done and just hit play on the movie in my head and started rocking that sci-fi thing, I was like, this feels so good. Like,
yeah,
I can just air it out and I can go right back to tie on part four, you know?
That's cool.
Yeah. It's, you know, speaking to that, when you guys get started, like you've got, you know, the multiple lines of effort, when it comes time to start a new book, do you guys just like take off and get like a, go get a cabin in the woods or something and do a writer's room? Or do you guys just, you know, just meet up for dinner some night and just start scribbling? Do you break down time to cultivate the, you know, you said Sons of Valor, tier 1-8. So when tier 1-9 comes around, are you guys like, all right, wives, we'll be back in like a week. We're going to go to like Miami, and we won't be on South Beach the whole time, but we're going to go have a writer's room. Right.
That would be cool. We always joke if we lived in the same city, you know, we'd never get anything done. So that's why we live in different places. I mean, when we start, what we do is it's usually we finish. It seems like the books always finish on the Friday, or sometimes we have to work through the weekend. And then that Monday morning, when we're ready to start the next project, it's like, all right, let's blank slate. Let's talk about where we left off and where we want to go. And because we sort of write in trilogies in our series, like Sons of Valor 3, we knew exactly Well, I shouldn't say we knew exactly, but we had a really good idea where we left off with Kasim and what was going to happen, and that we wanted it to be in London. And so then we had to map out just how to accomplish that. But when Sons of Valor 4 comes around and we have to start the next bad guy in the next trilogy, you know, that's going to be a heavier lift and that'll take longer. But usually we start on a Monday, and it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of brainstorming and outlining. And then we, then by the end of that first week, we got to rock and roll and we start putting words on the page.
Nice. And do you guys, and it's one thing or the other, from every author I talk to, people who outline every chapter or people who are just like, what if this happens? And they just start writing. Did you guys have to come together on that? Or were you guys on the same page as far as method goes when you started?
I mean, I was a little more of an outliner than he was, but I was never like a super detailed outliner. He was always a pantser, writing by the seat of his pants. And so for just the sake of organization, when we first started, we both agreed we would write in 3-act structure. So that makes it easy. We agreed we would write third person, multi-POV. We were already doing that. So then like for tier one, we started and I said, okay, I'll sort of map out this chapter list. And it would say like, you know, chapter one, POV, John Dempsey, setting, key, you know, elements for the chapter. And there'd be like a little paragraph that'd be like, you know, this opens in the Adriatic, they're on a boat, blah, 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 blah. This is going to happen, it's going to happen. And that would, you know, we would shuttle those assignment, like, you know, we'd say this chapter's Jeff, this one's Brian, next one's Brian's. We'd have our chapter assignments and then we'd go off and do it. But now that we've written so many books together, we still do that, but instead of a full page, it's just chapter 43, Jeff, you know, Dempsey POV, set in Nepal, blah, 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 you know, yeah. and then we go.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. It's all those things that, man, it's so organized, you know. It's I'm pretty jealous that you can get up and be like, yep, we're going to work on this day, and just more creative as a day comes. You're like, oh, we wrapped that. What are we doing next? You know, I can't wait to reach that period where I can just get up and be like, where am I writing today?
You know? Yeah.
someday it'll come. You know, I mentioned earlier, writing for WEB and now the Clancy books. I've had Jerome Priestler and Mark Cameron on, and their take on working with the estate and the freedom that they give them. What's your experience been with work? Just, hey, how did the Clancy estate be like, hey fellas, I got an idea. Is that about how it happened?
I mean, what happened for us is that, you know, Tom Colgan approached us to write Rogue Asset, which was in number 7 in the Presidential Agent series. Number 7 or number 6? One of those. And that was in the Webb Griffin estate. But he, you know, the estate basically turns over control of the series to Putnam. And so Tom is the editor who's in charge of the estate work. And he was Tom Clancy's editor at the end. So he knew Tom. He handpicked Mark Greeny to start writing the series. He's handpicked all the authors, actually. So for us, in our case, we started on that Webb Griffin book and we wrote it. And I think Tom's feedback to us was, he's like, wow, he's like, I didn't really expect you guys to go global and geopolitical with this book. So like Rogue Asset was set in Sudan. We wrote it about a year. Well, we wrote it maybe a year and a half. I mean, we wrote it maybe 2 years before, and it pubbed like a year before the actual civil unrest happened in Sudan. And so we sort of were prescient. That's what the story was about. Sort of a coup to overthrow the government, the presidential agent comes in. And so when that sort of all like happened in real life, I think Tom was like, wow, this is cool. These guys really sort of have their thumb on the pulse of global politics. And Mark Cameron had told Tom that he's like, I only want to do you know, one or two more books. So then Tom started thinking about who will I bring in to replace Mark? And the negotiations with the Griffin Estate broke down for the next book in that series. So then he calls us and like, would you guys jump into the Clancy series? And we're like, whoa, like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, would you like to take over for Mark Cameron when he finishes up? And so that was how it happened.
Wow. That's, and did you, as far as continuity goes, how far back are, I mean, as Clancy, I mean, it's hard to put that a Clancy book. Did you have to go back and get continuity over time, or did you meet up with Mark and be like, all right, this is where we've been. This is, cause there's so many different aspects of a Clancy novel. Just picking it up and making sure you get all those details right, because the readers are going to hang you, you know, if you miss a detail. How did you spin up, I guess, to get up to speed?
Well, we thought that would be what we needed to do. And we did get with Mark and we did talk with Mark, but an interesting opportunity presented itself to us, which is that our book, Act of Defiance, comes out on the 40th anniversary Hunt for October. And so when Tom Colgan was asking us, what do you guys want to write about? And we started pitching ideas. He was like, oh, Mark already did that. Mark Greene already did that. And, oh, well, Don just did that. And, you know, so there's 20, ours is number 24. And there's been like 10 in this junior series. I mean, think about this. You've got these brilliant people who are writing in this Clancy universe. Like, how do you come up with a new idea? I mean, that hasn't already been done. I mean, we had a couple ideas, and then, you know, and then after that, we went back. We were like, all right, we got two more new ideas. And he's like, oh, I'm so sorry to tell you this, but that's what Mark Cameron's going to do for his next book. And then the one after, he's doing something similar. We're like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. You know, so we were like, okay. And then when we realized that AOD is coming out on the 40th anniversary Hunt for October, we just said, well, why don't we do a big submarine book? Why don't we do something that pays homage to Red October? And so, and we did something else, which is we brought in Katie Ryan. So the twins, Kyle and Katie, have never been featured. Well, I mean, they appeared in, you know, Patriot games when they're little, but as adults, they have not entered the Ryanverse. And so we thought, oh, this could be really cool if we have an opportunity to bring the twins into the Ryanverse. And so what we did is we created a novel that has a lot of the same elements and feel and nostalgia of Hunt for Red October as if it was happening today in modern times. And then, you know, Jack Ryan is the president. He cannot be out there on submarine, you know, airdropping on submarines and doing that sort of crazy stuff. He's in the Oval Office. And so now, you know, that element of in the field falls to Katie Ryan. So it's really exciting for us. And, you know, even if you hadn't read Mark's last book, you will be fine. You can pick this book up and read it. And then as we get into the next two books that we're going to write, that's when we're going to kind of, I think, have to go back and really look at the book that Mark is working on right now. We haven't read it because it's not done. But as soon as that's done, and because the production schedule is so fast, that's the other thing. Like, we didn't even know what he was going to do. Even if we didn't write Act of Defiance the way we did, we still wouldn't have had his book in time. We had to start ours without knowing what's going on. So if you look at Act of Defiance as a little stopgap, it gives us a chance to read Mark's new book. And then geopolitically, we can decide, okay, well, Act of Defiance happened in there, but any important elements from Mark's last book will go into the next book we write.
Yeah. As you're mentioning, you know, Katie Ryan, the big sister to Jack Jr., who's been around now a while. And I just remember, the Patriot games, Some of All Fears, the Clear and Present Danger era. Jack's a baby, and the whole family's fussing over Jack Jr. And then to now, you know, Jack Jr.'s been in the game, you know, 10 years now, and then Katie's out there. So all I could think in my head was Katie stuck someplace and Jack just showing up with a big shitty grin on his face, being like, yeah, who's in charge?
Exactly.
Now? Hey, big sister Dan.
Yeah.
I don't know. You can take that. Take that idea.
Okay. You got it.
Yeah. That's just, man, I grew up devouring Clancy books. So it's just, I can't imagine getting that call. I'm just being like, yeah, I'm clearing my calendar. When do we start? You know,
it's exciting. It's a big honor. It's a big honor.
Yeah. That's awesome. And it, and that you get to write Jack Ryan, you know, the man, I mean, yeah, he's in the strategic level. He's stuck in the Oval Office now, but you're still writing Jack Ryan said this, right?
I know.
You're writing canon.
It's incredible.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. Let's see. As I was going through your website, I found a couple pages that I wanted to touch on, and the first one was the recipes. Like how'd you guys come up with the recipes?
I mean, that was kind of the result of just some smack talking with, you know, Ward Larson and Don Bentley and Josh Hood. You know, we love the great thing about the thriller community these days is that you have a lot of veterans who are writing in the space, you know. So Tom Clancy was never a veteran. He did not serve. And Robert Ludlum was not a spy. You know, like Vince Flynn was not a CIA asset, you know, or operator. These guys were civilians who were interested in the covert world, who did amazing research and wrote really thrilling books, but it was all their imagination. Whereas now, after, you know, post 9/11, post Iraq, Afghanistan wars, we have a whole new generation of people who've been there, done that, that are good storytellers and are telling the stories. And so we're just so grateful for that community. And, you know, part of it is just bringing our Navy bullshit, you know, let's rip on Army sort of mentality, right, you know, to social media. And so we were trying to do, we're just trying to find a fun way to engage with other military veteran thriller writers and also maybe raise a little bit of awareness and money for Folds of Honor. So we came up with this idea of doing a craft cocktail challenge. The country music star John Rich, he's a big supporter of Folds of Honor. He's been very generous and nice to us too. So he opened his bar, Redneck Riviera in Nashville. We created a craft cocktail called the Sons of Valor. They had it at the bar. And then we asked those other guys to, you know, come up with their own recipes and we'd post them. And that was that. It was just having fun, you know, having fun.
Yeah, I got to tell you, it's I have a strict no drinking on school nights policy, but I got to tell you, it's a mix between either Friday night's either going to start with a Texas Forever or Tom Colgan's Tears.
Yeah,
I'm not sure which, but they're calling my name. Like 2 ounces of Redneck Riviera over ice, a little bit of club soda, and a little bit of lime juice. That's a great way to start a weekend. And then Bentley's Tabasco sauce feels like it's gonna hurt in a minute, but that'll probably follow up on Saturday night. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's
if fun. You make one, you gotta post on social media with the picture.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There will be one of those on Instagram on Friday night, maybe two. I don't know. Depends on what I got going on Saturday. the other piece. On top of your publishing schedule that you've mentioned, your guys' film and TV work is, I mean, that's, so in a work day, you know, cause that's the way I look at this is, you know, my work day is, you know, every day I have a word count. I have a set of hours that I work at this job. And, so I wonder, you guys, I'd imagine with your schedule, you have to divvy up your days. Do you divvy up film days and writing days, or do you have like, okay, 10 to 12, we're working on Sons of Valor, you know, 1 to 3, we're working on the next script. How do you guys organize your time?
Yeah. So that's kind of what we're having to do now is, you know, in the morning, we'll write, then, you know, midday, maybe we'll conduct some business. A lot of our Zooms happen midday. And then afternoon might be working on treatments or screenplays or short stories. And then, you know, unfortunately right now, there's just been a lot of weekend work. It's because we're just so busy. And that looks like it's going to continue for quite some time. And that's taking a little bit of a toll, you know, having to work, you know, nights and weekends and stuff. But I'm not, we're not, the thing is, you know, it's a feast or famine business, and we know that. And, you know, we have to take advantage while, you know, while there's opportunity. So, you know, we do, our general policies, we just don't say no to anything. And so we're going to continue to work on all the series and all the treatments and screenplays that people will throw our way until the point that one of us dies.
That's a good plan. I mean, that's sounds about right. So when I've looked around at, I've studied the screenplay fascinates me because it's, you know, you write 100,000 words, that's, you know, good 360 pages. For a movie, it's 90 to 120 pages, 2 hours, everything you want to tell within outline form. And yeah. It's, my brain has had a hard time kind of adjusting to telling the story by almost bullet points, you know, but this formatting is a different way that nobody's ever, you don't study in school, you don't study a narrative. Yeah. You know? It's, was that something that came natural to you guys or just something you've grown into? For me, I've studied it over and over again, just thinking it'd be so much fun to try it. And then one day I'm mapping out my next book and I'm like, this outline is like 80% of a scene. You know, yeah. All I got to do is have the slug line. I got to have the whatever, set the scene and boom, dialogue. So I'm playing around with it a little bit that way. How were you able, was it an easy transition to go from laying down narrative to working in that very limited screenplay environment?
I don't think it's easy. It's a different way of thinking. And we're just getting started on that stuff. What the typical process is for most people who aren't aware is, you know, you sell your rights, you know, your IP is optioned by a studio or a producer. And in general, they're going to want to bring their own writers in, you know, especially if they're going for a big budget, you know, high production value sale that they want to sell to Amazon or Netflix or Apple Plus or whatever, they're probably going to want to attach an A-list screenwriter or showrunner with a lot of experience under their belt. So in those cases, you know, we have like a dozen properties that are in development. Most of them are in development with other people who are going to attach or who have attached as the screenwriters. We have two that we're looking at, one that we're under contract as the screenwriter already, and then another one that we're very hopeful will be the screenwriters. And that feels about right for us right now. Like that's what we can handle. And I think if the one that we have the deal on to be the screenwriters, if it goes really well, you know, then we'll want to do some more. Or, you know, what we were thinking is that, you know, once a streaming series gets up and running, you know, we're executive producers, we'll get to know the writers and, you know, there'll probably be an episode or two in every season that we contribute heavily to. I'm sure they'll need to lean on us for ideas.
Yeah. That's, when I looked at that, I'm like, that's, you know, adding on top of the writing schedule. It's like, but if that sounds like a team effort, you guys get to lay out ideas and have the professional script writer who wouldn't work in that format.
Yeah.
Just put it on paper. That's
yeah.
Yeah. That sounds cool. For me, it's like, you know, the first book I was like, well, that sounds cool. Let me just see if I can write a book. And I was like, oh, that's sweet. That was fun. I'm going to do it again. And now, and then the screenwriting thing, I'm like, that's such an alien thing I'm looking at. I just wonder if I can do it. So that's just, I've just been playing with it. Like, can I tell a story in that mode? And it's,
yeah.
Ooh, that's a tough one. That takes some time. That's a hard thing to wrap your brain around. But I just wanted to mention that. I was like, man, I'm fascinated by it because I don't understand it. I think it's pretty much where it goes. But man, I've kept you for almost an hour. I wanted to you do a lot of work for the veteran community. I wanted to see if are there any events coming up or you got any projects or anybody you want to give a shout out to as we, you know, since I see that you got a few partnerships and some charities that you work with.
Yeah. So I think one of the great things that we feel fortunate is that we've had this veteran entrepreneurship community that we consider ourselves a part of. So I talked a little bit about, you know, the veteran authors. You know, I encourage people to pick up copies of, you know, Don Bentley, Josh Hood, Ward Larson's work, you know, all the veteran authors out there. They're doing fantastic work. On the entrepreneurship side and charity side, you know, we support Seal Legacy Foundation. Jeff has a personal connection with the Mark McGinnis, who's the founder of the nonprofit. We've been supporting them from the very beginning. We developed a relationship with Tom and Jen Satterley at the All Secure Foundation, which is really focuses on PTSD, but not just for the service member, but also for the spouse and family members, because that's sort of the point of All Secure, is that, you know, the spouse and family members are equally stressed. They go through their own version of PTS from what their spouse is going through. And that's been under recognized and underappreciated. So we support them. And then, you know, folks like Tim Cruikshank at Bone Frog Coffee, give Tim a shout out. He'd be a fun guy for you to have on podcast sometime. You know, he's a former Navy SEAL and started a coffee roasting company up in Seattle, Washington. And, you know, was just bootstrapped the whole thing himself. And you know, just fantastic. So yeah, all these people who are veterans that are in their second or third act now after service, you know, we want to support them because they've done a great job of just getting our name out there too. So
yeah, no, Bone Frog Coffee, you're speaking my language. But yeah, mentioning the spouses, often underlooked, but I don't know if I've mentioned this before or not, but you know, on the police side, I had a buddy who, we started out together. When he retired from the PD, one of the coolest things I've ever seen is, you know, he gets his shadow box, he gets his retirement certificate with his badge all in the shadow box and blazoned, all that good stuff. But they also did the same for his wife. So,
awesome.
He served for 25 years. She also served. I often think they got it worse than us because we're out there having fun. I mean, it's not always fun. It's sometimes very, very bad, but there's nothing more interesting. It's an interesting way to live your life, right?
Yeah.
But they're the ones sitting at home, you know, and if the news gets to them the wrong way, or if rumors get to them the wrong way, they're the ones who have to worry about it. Well, we're off being, you know, kids who never want to grow up, basically.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, they gave her the same display, the same recognition. It was a very, very cool thing that I hadn't seen prior to that.
I think that's wonderful, man.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the spouses never get the credit. I've often thought I'd really like to get Police Wives of America or some organization like that on here just to lay out the, you know, just how strong those people are, the spouses that allow us to go live the adventure, you know, sometimes, so to speak, time to time, But no, that's fantastic. I told you I wouldn't keep you much more than an hour, but when I have veterans on, I have the same question to wrap up as everybody.
Sure.
In different places, you know, law enforcement's under scrutiny lately. Military comes under scrutiny quite a bit as well. But you know, we're sitting here talking, you've got your experience as a veteran, 18-year-old kid, just getting ready to graduate high school, no idea what he wants to do with his life, but he's standing in front of the recruiting station and you walk by. What's your advice to him?
My advice is, if you feel called to serve, I think you should. I feel like whether that service is military service or Red Cross or Peace Corps or Teach for America, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be on the pointy tip of the spear for it to be service. What you do is service. Fire department is service. All these different communities that keep our civilian population safe and educated and informed, right? There's lots of different ways you can contribute. And I just feel like, you know, to call yourself an American and really understand what the values and sacrifices that this country is founded upon sort of demands that you give back. And I feel like, you know, to that 18-year-old, that's what I would say. Maybe you don't need to walk into that Marine Corps recruiter's office, but walk into somebody's office that's going to give you the opportunity for 2 to 4 years to go out there and try to make the world a better place and to try to support the country and your fellow citizen. Because then you have a right to complain about the stuff that you see that's wrong, because you've been out there trying to fix it and you've been out there understanding that, you know what, the reason that these things are wrong is because these are really hard, intractable problems that a bunch of really smart people have given their lives to trying to figure out. And guess what? If they were easy to solve, they'd all be solved, right? Yeah. And so I think once you get out there and you try to get your hands dirty and you try to get in the mud and realize, oh man, I see why it's a challenge at the border. I see why education is a problem. I see why teachers want to quit. I see why nurses, you know, are burned out. You'll appreciate the different people that you interact with on a daily basis throughout your life.
Yep. Yeah. To be a part of a community means to serve the community. And it's there's no better way to put it. Yeah. It's especially, people are so quick to criticize. But, you know, if you're out there part of an organization or whatever your mission is, you know, you get to see other aspects. You know, especially if you're in something like the Navy, you're in one of our armed services, you get to go see these different places, and there's no quicker way to get an appreciation of where you come from and how much of a light on the hill we are. We have faults, but for all our faults, there's no better place to be a citizen, a resident or citizen of than the United States.
And yes,
it's a great way to get an understanding of how important that is.
Yeah,
exactly that, making the world a better place. So. But Brian, I appreciate you coming on, and your socials and your website.
Yeah, so our website is easy. It's andrews-wilson.com. And on there, we have a list of all our books, and we'd encourage you to sign up for our newsletter. We don't spam. We only send one or two a quarter, just sort of keep you updated on new releases and exciting news for the brand. Our social is bandrewsjwilson on Twitter and Andrews and Wilson on Instagram and Facebook. And John, thanks for the great interview. And I'm so happy you had me on the show.
I'm glad you reached out. Thanks a lot, man.
All right.
All right.